to learn more about what I'm doing and what others have been doing in this area.
Well, again, Ray, thank you so much for being on the show and for your wonderful work.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
And that was Ray Johnson. They are a social worker, somatic movement therapist, and scholar activist working at the intersections of embodiment and social justice. And they are the author of Embodied Activism, Engaging the Body to Cultivate Liberation, Justice, and Authentic Connection. And that's it for this magical mystery tour. Thank you so much for listening. If you missed any of the show or would like to hear it again, you can find this and all Magical Mystery Tour shows at soundcloud.com/WGDR. That's
you are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in to Pathways, a show featuring conversations with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. Join me, host Paul O'Brien, or my co-host Donald Altman every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 a.m. You can find out more about the show or listen to the program archive at kboo.fm/pathways.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
Broadcasting from the Hip Hop Weekly Studios, I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Civic Cypher. I am your host, Ramses Ja.
Is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. You are listening to Civic Cypher.
You know what's crazy?
No, I don't know what's crazy.
Allow me to tell you. Stereotypes.
Stereotypes are kind of wild.
Yeah, and that's what we're going to talk about today. One of the things that comes up quite a bit in our conversations with people has to do with their upbringing being surrounded by stereotypes with respect to Black people. So today's show, we're going to be dealing with a lot of stereotypes. We're going to talk about an incident in Ohio of a couple that was shopping while Black. Man, the police called on them. And that's a very traumatic experience for a lot of Black people at different points in our lives. But it's kind of a shared trauma. And for folks that may not have access to it, we're going to give you some insight.
Wild Black as a suffix is really
yeah, sure.
Trouble.
We're also going to spend some time talking about protesting Wild Black.
Mm-hmm.
That Wild Black suffix often enough kind of makes it feel, you know, as reported by the news or just kind of in conversation, it makes it feel a little bit more sinister, a little bit more criminal.
It should feel sinister and criminal.
Right, because it's been designed to paint us in that way.
You feel that way.
Sure, sure. So, and we're also going to use our Way Black History Fact to talk about some the basis of a lot of these stereotypes as well. So a lot in store for you today. And hopefully this will be an educational episode for a lot of folks who've been wondering where the basis of all this stuff comes from. So we're definitely going to get into that. But first and foremost, we are going to be celebrating a tad bit of Ebony Excellence. Today's Ebony Excellence is brought to you by Major Threads, for the finest in menswear. Check majorthreads.com. And we have a video that we're going to play.
Hi, I'm Danae Benton, actor, thank you, and proud CMU alum. Earlier tonight, CMU and the Tony Awards presented the 2023 Excellence in Theater Education Award. And while I am certain that the current Grand Wizard, Governor of my home state of Florida will be changing. Sure. Society will be changing the name of this following town immediately. We were honored to present this award to the truly incredible and life-changing Jason Zembic Young. And
okay, so in short, that wonderful display of courage for calling out what we believe to be racist behavior and divisive leadership on the part of Ron DeSantis, calling that out was Broadway star Danae Benton, who's known for her roles in Hamilton and Into the Woods. Of course, she compared DeSantis to Ku Klux Klan leader, as she acknowledged Florida teacher Jason Zembic Young as the winner of this year's Excellence in Theater Education Award. And that amount of courage, and of course, on that type of stage, is a beaming example of ebony excellence if I've ever seen it. So I salute you. So now let's talk about shopping. So, you know, off the top of your head, can you think of any stories from your life where shopping was a particularly traumatic experience that you believe the trauma was based solely on your, or the additional trauma was based on you being Black?
For some of our listeners, I don't want to insult them by making this some singular occurrence that stood out in my head from the one time it happened. Like, of course, all the time.
All the time, yeah.
There's a movie when I was younger that was written, directed, and produced, I believe, by Eddie Murphy called Boomerang. Mm. And I remember there was a massive uproar in Hollywood and in the media because it was a movie about executives, like advertising executives in the fashion and like fragrances and, you know, in that whole world. And none of the main characters are white. And people were like really insulted and angered by it when that had been the case in the reverse for all of history. Yeah. And no one had anything to say. And there is a scene in that film where these very, very wealthy cosmetic marketing and advertisers, their executives, mm-hmm. are shopping at a men's clothing store. And the salesperson immediately reminds them that there's no layaway and that they don't keep cash in the store. Mm. These three gentlemen have on suits. It's very, very clear that they are well-to-do, if you will. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, marketing executives. Mm-hmm. But this salesperson saw three Black men. It didn't care or it didn't matter that they had money or how they were dressed or how they spoke. They were Black. Mm-hmm. So they had to be there to either steal something or they clearly could not afford anything that was there. So whenever they would grab something that they liked, he would make it known to them how expensive it was. Yeah. You know, that is $1,200 or, you know, whatever the price was, to kind of discourage them from even looking. Mm-hmm. And then reminded them, we don't have layaway. And when one of them simply suggested that they were okay before he walked away and left them alone, made sure that they knew, we don't keep cash in the store.
Yeah I think that that speaks to, that's sort of like art imitating life, because that was a movie, but that I think that illustrates how we have this as Black people, this collective trauma, almost like a shared experience. I know that if I encounter someone I've never met before but grew up in the United States, who's Black, might have grown up in a different city, different state, that they will understand the feeling of shopping while Black.
I mean, like you said, art imitating life. Mm-hmm. That's why that scene was in the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody Black that saw that movie understood it.
It was funny. Yeah. It
immediately. Yeah.
Not funny because it's funny, but funny because the movie perhaps captured it so well and it was so relatable, right? So in that way. Now, I want to share a story about when I was, I believe it was my first year of high school. But first, I want to discuss why we're talking about this. So as I mentioned, there is a video that has gone viral, and the Black Information Network actually covered the story. So I'll read a bit about the story just to kind of bring you, the listener, up to speed on what kind of triggered this, really this whole show, these stereotypes, right? So I'll read a bit. Bed Bath & Beyond is facing online backlash after staff at an Ohio store called the police on a black couple and accused them of shoplifting because they had too many, quote, high-ticket items in their cart. Footage posted by Lamar Richards on June 16th shows him and his boyfriend confronting store employees at a location in Toledo while a police officer is present. And this is him talking, quote, I'd like to understand why police were called. That's very simple. Why were the police called with the three black people thinking that we were shoplifting? He asked a female worker. He goes on to say, I paid $600 for my things, so obviously I didn't shoplift. I want to understand why you thought I was shoplifting. And then the staff member says, if there's a big purchase item, there's usually a question. We just want to make sure. Richard said, okay, usually a question, I can understand that. But police being called, I can't understand that. So we saw this video and we recognize that feeling that Richards and his partner were having in that moment. I believe there was a comment that he made that was very similar to the scene that you just described in Boomerang Q, where he says to the Richard says to the employee at the Bed Bath & Beyond, he says to her, I paid for this with a debit card, not with a credit card, using money that I earned with my degree. That was a statement.
I earned from my job.
With yeah, exactly.
With my degree.
That's a bar. That's a bar, ain't it? And, you know, for other people that feel like, oh, you know, it's just a misunderstanding. Oh, these people exist, Q. I see your face.
I'm sure they do. The problem is you'd have to be able to provide me a counterexample.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what.
To present it to me as a misunderstanding.
Sure.
And I know you can't because it doesn't happen.
Right. But these people exist. And so for those people in your world, our listener, maybe you recognize that this is a thing, but maybe the people around you don't. And the people that you have conversations with and trying to help us tell our stories. So for the people that think that this is, it might just be a misunderstanding, don't make a big deal out of it. Why are you filming? Why are you recording? Clearly, we're just protecting our interest. We didn't know it was an honest mistake, that sort of stuff, right? People, because people feel this way. Those people are not looking beyond the incident that is in front of them. Those people are not realizing that indeed it is a lifetime of having that sort of monkey on your back, in a manner of speaking, that nervousness when shopping through or walking through a store shopping. You know, the craziest thing, just a real quick example, the craziest thing for me is when I go into a store hoping to find something and I don't find what I'm wanting and I have to leave the store empty handed. It plagues me constantly. The reason for that is because if I go into the store and I don't find what I want and I have to leave the store empty handed, I still at 40 years old have that constant companion, that fear, that trauma that says they're going to think I came in here to steal something.
The really, really sad and really infuriating truth to what you just said is as soon as you said it, my stomach started hurting.
Because mm-hmm. you understand.
I knew exactly. I knew your why without you having to even express it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that way with going into a store and not buying something. It's that way when getting poor service and still
having a
feeling
tip.
Obligated to tip.
Yep.
You know, it is a, you know, that, like you said, that companion that's always with us where we have to make these decisions through this prism that is so incredibly unfair, so incredibly frustrating, but so incredibly ever present.
It's constant. Yeah. Yeah. So let me give you an example. Once upon a time, this is my, mind you, I have a ton of examples, but this one was very scary for me. Very, very scary for me. First, let me give you a little bit of background. if you're new to the show, you may not know this. My father was a minister. I don't say that because I believe it's necessarily virtuous. I say that because I understood quite well the difference between right and wrong, according to the majority of the principles that we share as human beings.
It speaks to a type of upbringing,
more than moral code.
Yeah, trying to come across as virtuous.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Q. So, I knew better than the steel. In addition, I recognized that the consequences for doing anything outside of what is expected of you while being Black are more severe than the consequences of doing something outside of what is expected of you while being white. In other words, if I, a Black person, wants to drink beer as an underage teenager in high school, the consequences would be far worse for me, potentially, if the police showed up, than they might be for, you know, my friends who were not as melanated, and on and on. The consequences for everything. Beer is a kind of a low-hanging example, but you can imagine.
No, I mean, but it's good to use a slightly benign example.
Thank you.
To point out the contrast, yep. Right? You show up to a party where the teenagers don't look like us, and it's a slap on the wrist, like, and almost very literally, you know, hey, don't do this again, we'll tell your parents kind of thing.
Yeah.
We're going to jail.
Yeah.
Charges are being pressed.
Yes.
Lawyers have to be involved.
Right. Parents, all that stuff.
Hopefully, that's all that happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hopefully, this does not escalate into something far more sinister for no reason at all, except for because of the way that you look.
Sure, sure. And it's important. So a lot of people that don't live in this skin or have the Black experience in the United States of America. And by that, I don't mean by proximity. I mean by actually waking up inside of a Black body with melanin, your body producing melanin that turns it brown, beautiful brown color. That experience, living that life, you cannot know the reality. And so for people who might say, listen, you're just imagining these things. It's the world is a fairer place than you think. We elected a Black president. You know, people think this, right? You cannot make that judgment only having lived the part of the experience that affords you the privilege to even fix your mouth to say that. I'll continue. As a teenager, I went to the mall after school, which is what we did. Once upon a time, we didn't all have cell phones and whatever, you know. We actually had to hang out with each other, and that was our friend group and our followers, et cetera, right? And a place to do this, place to be social, was at the mall, right? Went to the mall one day and went into, it might have been it was a drugstore, like a Walgreens or something. And I walked into the store through the outside door. In other words, I was using this store to gain access to the mall. It had two entrances, one from the mall side and one from outside. So I'm coming in from the outside. Walked into the store just fine. But mind you, I just got out of school, so I have my backpack on. I'm walking through the store. Remember, I'm not buying anything. I'm just going into the mall. And when I get to the front of the store, the alarm thing beeps. And you know, I've been through some really tense moments in my life. I've had to come to terms with my own mortality. I have not been that scared. Maybe 4 or 5 times ever. Because when that alarm beeped, those people got to manhandling me and they were yelling and screaming. And I didn't know what was going on because, of course, I didn't steal anything. I mean, just to give you the end of the story, I didn't steal anything. But the way that they approached me as though I was already convicted of the capital murder, you know what I mean? Like they had they wrestled me. You know, I'm physically not a big person. I was much smaller when I was in school. I was a child still. I might have been 14, right, ninth grade, you know. These are men, you know, the mall security, that sort of person. I don't remember if it was police or not, but it might have been because there were so many people there. And they pushed me over the counter after they took my backpack, and they had my hands behind my back and they were just holding me. I didn't get handcuffed or anything, but they were holding me there. And it was so aggressive. And then my friends that I was with, they were powerless because remember, they're children too. So they're standing on the other side. And they're thinking the worst. They're like, oh my God, Ramses got caught stealing in the store. How did he steal anything? We just walked through the store. So the end of that story is they started going through my backpack because obviously they were checking my person to see if I had anything, and then they go through my backpack. And then they take out, they first looked through my backpack. There's nothing in my backpack except homework and like pencils and stuff. So they're putting they put the backpack through the beeping machine or whatever to see if the shoplifting gate, I guess. And then my backpack beeped. I remember that. And then they started taking my backpack, everything out of it. So the big zipper and then the little tiny zipper, and they're putting everything through to try to figure out what was beeping the thing. Then they took out, there used to be these notebook holders, and they were like kind of like trapper keepers sort of things. It's basically would hold all your homework and your notes and everything from your different classes. They took out my trapper keeper thing and they held that through the
Ramses is saying trapper keeper thing because that is from a generation prior.
Yeah, you may not know.
Most of us know what a trapper keeper is. He's I'm watching his face as he's trying to describe a thing that has a folder. It'd be like saying, you know, a Coca-Cola thing. Like, no, just a Coke.
Yeah.
Well, a trapper keeper.
Yeah, that's what I had. Anyway, so they held it through the machine and it, or the gate thing, and they beat. So then they zipped it open and it's trapper keeper, and it's like kept everything safe. So they zipped it. It was basically like a folder or a briefcase, but for kids, right? Opened it up. I had to explain it. Opened it up. And it still had that tag that causes the gates to beep in it. Now you could visibly look at it and see that it was worn. It was well used. I had it for, maybe I had it all that year, but I suspect because I didn't grow up with a lot of money, if the stuff still was working, let it ride, I probably had it for a few years. But that little sticker that causes the alarm to beep was still in the folder. And so when I initially purchased it, because I did, well, my mom purchased it for me to go to school, it had it in there and they never took it off, right? So that at 14 years old, confirmed exactly what it was that I thought might happen if I was suspected of shoplifting. Call the authorities. It's a 4-alarm fire. Let's get everybody down here. There's a criminal, you know, and they don't come to the table with, hey, this might be a misunderstanding, like they do, because I've seen this happen.
Oh, yeah,
at affluent department stores, because I shop in places like
this. Built-in benefit of the doubt for everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Is triggering.
Yeah. Excuse me, ma'am. We must have forgotten to take something off of one of your items. Can we check that out and make sure that you're okay? Even if that person is suspected of stealing, you spare them the humiliation.
That person is stealing.
Yeah. You spare them the humiliation. And in my case, they were hurting me. I'll never forget that. Like I was that afraid. In that moment, I somehow disappointed my mother, my family, my friends, my community. You know, I always tried to do the right thing. I always tried to be a good person. I'm not going to say that I've always been perfect. I've had to learn what it means to be a man.
Yeah, I'm not.
That's called growing up. But
perfect is not even a word that I can use for anything I've ever done throughout my entire existence. Somebody called me perfect before, it made me cringe.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah,
we are learning.
We ain't that over here.
But listen, watch this. I think this example and your example also shows how the point I'm trying to make, which is I had to learn despite having a strong moral code and an upbringing, kind of knowing more or less what was right from wrong, I had to learn what it meant to be a good man.
Yeah.
I had to learn. And oftentimes we don't have the grace as Black men to be able to learn, to make a mistake and learn from it. We're held to a standard of adults when we're children. Well, and treated like adults.
Yeah, that's because two things are true. One is that criminal element is baked in if you look like us.
Right.
So the reason why you're not given any grace is because you're not making a mistake. You're being a criminal. That's what you are. That's who you are. So you're doing what it's in your nature to be that.
Right.
You know what I mean? And we're assumed to also always be poor. You know, I thought of an example while you were telling your story, just to make this as quick as I possibly can. When I was shopping for my car.
Yes.
The car that I have now. Yeah. And I remember I was asking all of these questions, and the guy said to me in these words, so I ended up, of course, not buying a car from him. "You're asking all these questions, sir. Can you even afford this car?"
No.
And I was like, wow. Now, of course, I didn't wear a suit to the car dealership, but to be petty, I did screenshot my account balance at the time. And it just so happened that this was this way. I don't want anybody to read into this. I had enough money in my account that day to buy the car cash. So
it's a nice car.
Very nice car. The sales manager at that dealership got a screenshot of my account balance. I did not have that kind of money for real. But that day, the account balance was popping.
Yeah.
And I got to send that screenshot to that sales manager. As you can imagine, he was very upset and did a lot to try to win my business back, but it was too late. Because I knew the only reason this person assumed I couldn't afford this car
was
because I look like Q. Mm.
I think Q is a good looking man.
I appreciate you, brother.
Yes, sir.
Likewise.
Listen up. We got a lot more here. We're going to take a pause for the cause.
Wild black man. That's
sure. Stereotypes, man. They really do have real world impacts. We're going to talk more about it in just a second.
And now,
Proper propaganda. Watch it. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists with journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders.
You're just tuning in to Civic Cypher. I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. You guys are back to Civic Cypher.
Indeed you are. Got a lot more in store for you, so be sure to stick around. We're still talking about stereotypes and how they impact our lives and shape outcomes. We're going to be talking about protesting while Black. This is a big one for us, because how do we change the world if we are not able to make our voices heard, or if that act appears criminal and the optics surrounding it make us appear more sinister than we actually are?
Listen, Ramses, if you don't like it here, leave.
That's unacceptable, because that would be me failing you, my non-Black brothers and sisters. You deserve better than what you've been shown. We're also going to discuss the roots of some stereotypes in our Way Black History Facts. So stick around for that as well. But right about now, let's take a break and let's talk about becoming a better ally. Baba. So today's BABA Baba is sponsored by Unknown Union, the fashion house situated at the intersection of meaning, innovation, and culture. For more info, check out unknownunion.com. I'm going to be reading from Essence Magazine. A skate park in California has been named in honor of Tyree Nichols, a Black motorist who was killed in January in what prosecutors said was a fatal beating by police in Tennessee during a traffic stop. Obviously, we talked about Tyree Nichols and still talk about Tyree Nichols. I'll keep reading. Nichols, who was an avid skateboarder, spent much of his time as a youth at the park on the outskirts of Sacramento. City officials and others held a ribbon-cutting ceremony for the newly renovated skate park, now named for Nichols, the Associated Press reports. The 29-year-old moved to Memphis, Tennessee shortly before the coronavirus pandemic in 2020 and resided with his mother and stepfather. He enjoyed photography, especially taking photos of landscapes and sunsets. And one of the cool things that happened, many of you may know that I host a podcast for iHeart and Black Information Network. Q sometimes guest hosts on this podcast, and Q actually was able to interview Tyree Nichols' good friend, Jerome Neal Jr., who I believe was involved in this effort. And you got to talk to him for a little bit, right?
Yeah, it was a difficult conversation to have because, again, speaking in the past tense about,
yeah,
he wasn't a kid, he was a young man. but in the very, very early sunrise of his life. Mm. And so much that he didn't get to experience again, once again, because of that suffix.
Mm. Wild Black.
Wild Black. Driving, skating, teaching, living, shopping, eating. When you put Wild Black on the end of all of those things, we collectively understand what's coming.
Yeah.
What's coming in the rest of that conversation.
Now, listen. Okay. We're going to talk about protesting now, but I don't want this conversation to sound to you, our listener, like, woe is me. We believe that we can all be better to each other.
I think it is criminal that we have to qualify it like
that. Yeah, but
because there are people that will hear this and very apathetically, their minds will go right to, woe is me.
They're always complaining. Yeah. And
I didn't mean to cut you off.
No. I think that's the perfect way to kind of segue, because they're always complaining is often the attitude adopted by people who want nothing to do with it. What is the saying that we hear so often? I'm paraphrasing. I don't know if this is exactly it, but to the privileged, equality feels like oppression. And I believe it's something like that. Mm-hmm. And so voicing our concerns or complaining, as this imaginary person might call it, is perhaps annoying, right? And so they want what they get often from the media, which is what we're talking about today when it comes to protesting, which is basically an amplified version of complaining. So I appreciate you setting me up for the segue here. Protesting while Black. Now, Q and I were on another radio show called The Beat Lock with a good friend of ours. Shout out to Poker Face. This was a recent interview that we did. And we were asked about the origin story for this show here, Civic Cypher. And for those that don't know the origin story, this show was based out of the protests of 2020. Q and I would show up to the protests for obvious reasons. but also at the time, Q and I were radio personalities on a hip hop station. I guess we are. We're on way more hip hop stations now, but this was our occupation. We were DJs, radio personalities. This is kind of what we did. We were nightclubs and we talked on the radio, right? So being out there, we felt like, hey, we should probably capture some of this magic, some of these narratives, some of these conversations, and put it on the radio so that we can combat the narrative that is being chronicled by the news outlets saying that we're out rioting. Mm-hmm. These are not riots, as illustrated by the fact that we are here with our children, and indeed many of our allies are here with their children as well. There's no riots, there's no smoke, there's no burning, none of this sort of stuff, right? But we would go home at the end of the day and watch the news, and we would see that it was reported that there were riots. And it's like, well, that didn't happen where we were.
Overtly slanted.
Yeah. Yeah.
Negative, kind of violent, inciting,
mm-hmm, exactly. Reporting. So what would happen is police would end up cornering certain activists, and they were targeted because they had the facial recognition stuff. And this is, we're talking about our city in Phoenix. You feel free to check this out because they've had to come out and admit all this stuff. But they had facial recognition things that they set up on different corners. I have a couple of businesses downtown, so I was down there every day. This was happening. So I saw this stuff. They had the sound cannons and all the police presence and all that sort of stuff. They were targeting specific folks. I suspect they weren't targeting me and you because of our higher profile and our capacity to.
I mean, I don't know, because our profiles are a lot higher now.
Now, yeah.
I think they weren't targeting us because the proximity to our children made us move very, very carefully in those spaces.
Perhaps that was it. But I know for a fact that
we stayed out of the way.
Right. But I know for a fact that at least my name was on those people's radar for being there. Again, no crimes, nothing like that.
Again, sometimes when you're there and you look like you, there's the crime.
Go ahead and say it. So we're telling our story. We're describing what's going on. And then the narrative that we're seeing on the news is that it's criminal activity. The police were picking off protesters here and there. They'd turn a wrong corner or be going to their car or whatever. And then the police would swoop in. Other folks would see it and try to go and help and protect, because again, you got to understand the climate of the country at that time. You see police running after someone black, immediately you're like, oh my God, the worst could happen. This happened to us when we were pulled over in Mississippi. People were crying because they were fearing the worst about what could have happened to us based on what they were seeing our interaction with the police. Now, parts of those clips were being shared, and then it was, like you said, they were kind of skewing the conversation in such a way to suggest that the protests were unsafe, that the police and the protesters were fighting somehow, which isn't true. The police have guns. Protesters have bullhorns. It's not the same. You know what I mean? But this is kind of what helps the media keep the viewership of the people who really want it to be true that black people are always complaining, and that, you know, the people that have the privilege to whom equality feels like oppression. Go ahead.
You know, the really interesting thing is, even for those who are the most cynical of our position and really, really feel like, you know, like, again, woe is me and you guys are always complaining, how our law enforcement responds is very, very telling. You know, so the people are probably wondering about the wild black part, especially considering so many of the protesters here were not black, except the cause they were standing for
was real black,
very black.
Yeah.
And therein lies the difference. Even, quote unquote, their own are treated the way that we're treated if you're standing up for us.
Yeah.
And the largest example was January 6th. Because prior to that, when the idea was Black Lives Matter protesters will be present, the police militarized themselves, tanks, riot gear, and came out in
facial recognition.
And came out in mass. I'm not even talking about the technology. I'm talking about the physical presence.
Yeah, they came out with big guns.
Yeah. And full tactical gear.
They look like soldiers,
but to make sure we didn't show up and harm any property.
Yeah.
January 6th, a date that they were made privy was coming. They were told, we're going to go not just show up, we're going to go take over.
Yeah.
And they were conspicuously absent because white supremacy has a very hard time checking white supremacy. A very hard time.
Dang, that's a bar. All right, let me give you this. So we're talking about riots. We're talking about protesting that are described as riots and then fed to the masses. And these things help shape public opinion. And this is what leads to stereotypes. Okay. Dr. King, he's known for his nonviolent, peaceful protests, his marches, right? He's known for that now. Awesome. He is not known for that when he was doing
He was known for it, then he just wasn't celebrated for it.
Okay, that's a good way to say it. However,
he was infamous for his marches and his speeches he was alive.
So watch this. There would be, let's say he did 5 marches. There might be a skirmish between the protesters and the police at 2 of them. And in our estimation, it was probably provoked by the police.
Okay.
But that's all that's necessary for
this time. I do mean to cut my brother off.
Go ahead.
Because of his grace. I love Ramses. He said that those skirmishes were probably yes, I paused on purpose. The mic did not cut off. Those skirmishes were probably started or instigated by the police.
Yeah.
There's video, people. We don't have to use probable, right? I guess we have to, you know, what do they say in court? Allegedly, even when they have
video. The video, it's funny.
So yeah, I'm going to say those skirmishes, were allegedly started by the police and their dogs and fire hoses. Sure. And billy clubs and yeah.
So while he was alive, folks like to challenge that narrative that he was a peaceful, benevolent leader type of individual. Hence his 20% approval rating among white Americans, and critically, his 20% approval rating among Black Americans. Right? So stereotypes can affect Black people as well. Okay. Now, of course, we know the end of that story. Dr. King is, as you mentioned, Q, celebrated for his nonviolent approach to changing at least that time in American history for the better for marginalized people. Right. But it wasn't until after his death that the government took it seriously and actually changed some lighting. What might have been it wasn't Nixon, what's his name, I can't think of his name, anyway, one of the presidents changed the laws after his death, because there were so many eruptions around the country after that. So protests. Dr. King said that a riot is the language of the unheard. Now there are people that push back and say, listen, you need to be patient. You guys need to be patient. These things move slowly. The wheels of society turn very slowly. This is a long road. I say that. I have occupied different space, but
yes, you do.
Yeah, I occupy a different space, but I can say that because I'm indeed marching on that road. Someone else in a position of power cannot say that to me, because they don't get to define what justice should be like or how long it should take. And I want to quote James Baldwin. Actually, do me a favor. You can read the James Baldwin quote, because I know you love this one.
I might get this quote tattooed because I do love it. And it is a quote that Ramses is laughing as he says he knows I love it, because Ramses encourages me and reminds me that this progress is slow.
Mm-hmm.
And that we should be patient and one step at a time and yada, yada, yada. And this incremental approach to this progress that could overnight, by way of legislation, just be changed is insulting to me. James Baldwin said, and I quote, "It has taken my father's time, my mother's time, my uncle's time, my brother's time, and my sister's time, my niece's and nephew's time. How much time do you want for your progress?"
Ooh-wee.
Right? The multiple lifetimes of our ancestors. We've already given that time. You've already taken that time. In what world do we get where we're going? Do I pass away knowing or having some type of understanding that for my grandchildren, things will be different, that things will be better? That's still a question.
I think I'm going to add to it that you're saying that it is possible for things to change overnight. So I think that statement in and of itself suggests, more than suggests, that it is very possible to make huge sweeping changes, not just in terms of laws, but in terms of public opinion and how we interact with each other over the course of a lifetime. To where a person could see the world is in a much better place than it was when we started.
Hence my frustration.
So I'm with you. So watch this. Now, we talked about protesting, because often enough, protesting is the language that we have that is has been relatively consistent in terms of our plight, in terms of our arsenal toward achieving a more equitable America. Let me say what I'm going to say. Watch this. When we want to vote, sometimes that's taken away from us. There are countless Black men permanently disenfranchised because they're convicted felons. We could talk about that. That is almost grotesquely unfair, but permanently disenfranchised. We can talk about access to voting. We can talk about gerrymandering, weakening the strength of a Black person's vote, which weakens the value of the Black person's experience in terms of input to the relative, to the overall American experience, right? And so protesting is kind of that last vestige, that last tool that many people feel like they have. And for that to then be villainized and conflated with rioting is exceptionally unfair. And it's based on stereotypes that I do want to challenge. Now, I want you to jump in right here, but I got some examples that will help me challenge this idea of what a protest is. Go ahead.
I guess my problem is more with the idea that protesting is somehow still a vehicle for us. I don't think it is. Now, we do it kind of out of a duty. There's no outcome. We don't leave City Hall after our protest and then they text us like, okay, you guys came out, we heard you. We're gonna, like, no, that doesn't happen, right? So it's more a symbol of solidarity and a way for us to air our grievances and our frustrations amongst each other. The lawmakers and the policymakers, they don't come out to these protests, listen to our plight, hear our points, take that back to their body and make changes based on that anymore. And once upon a time, I think the idea of a protest was so scary, right? There would be, in some cases, like boycotts and strikes, there are fiscal damages that happen. People lose money and they respond to that. But us just showing up in mass upset does not tend to really move the needle like it once did.
Now, I'm not going to disagree with you, but I can't wholly agree with you there. I think that there may still be some value, but critically, if you have no other form of representation in terms of the government, then showing up with your person and the sign is not nothing. No, sitting at home is nothing.
Be right? clear. I did not say it was nothing.
Right.
And I also did not say it didn't have value.
Yeah.
It is just not the vehicle that it once was.
Sure. Okay.
And that's we can quantify that.
Yeah. I want to make sure that like I said, I'm not going to disagree with you, but I want to make sure that we say that for our listeners.
It has qualitative value, okay. Not quantitative.
Now, here's what I want to do. For folks that take issue with riots, first off, earlier we were talking about, you know, shopping while Black, right? And how stereotypes work. The stereotypes that Black people steal, right? But the truth is that other people steal from Black people. Culture, of course. Liberty, as I mentioned, right to vote, access to, you know, representation, etc. Wealth. This country's story is littered with massacres and riots and legislation and so forth. Terrorism, Black codes, Jim Crow, redlining, the GI Bill, etc., of stealing wealth from Black people. Stealing.
Very right? intentionally, too, not just happenstance.
Hold on.
We weren't collateral damage. We were the target.
Yeah, to take from us, yes. Right? Life. Stealing life from us. We talk about Black life being snuffed out all the time and people getting away with it with no consequences.
Creation, intellectual property.
But even if it's not,
and go on.
Even if we're not talking about murder, we just talked about the prison industrial complex. People get sentenced unfairly in this country. It's stealing life, okay? Now, Black people have the stereotype, but I don't think that that's entirely fair. I'm going to make another point here. Black people have a stereotype of being aggressive, rioters when we're protesting. So I'm going to read some stuff about riots for sports teams around the country that celebrated, or I guess rioted, after the
as
sports
a form team, of celebration,
right, or of loss. I'm going to just read these just so you know. And I want you to ask yourself, why is there no stereotype that these people riot? But why is there a stereotype to Black people? I'm going to read. Denver Nuggets, obviously they won the national championship recently. This was a couple weeks ago, maybe. 2 hours later, thousands went to McGregor Square and destroyed it. In Boston in 2004, 2007, and 2013, the Red Sox was the baseball team. Everybody got out there and rioted all three of those years. Boston. Okay. Detroit, 1984. Detroit has a team called Tigers. They probably play some cool sport. And then
the Detroit Tigers are a baseball team.
Boom. That's what I was on. All right. And then 1990, the Detroit Pistons. That's a basketball team. I know them. In 2011, the Vancouver Canucks lost the 2011 Stanley Cup to the Boston Bruins, and fans trashed parts of the city, causing millions of dollars in damage. Philadelphia Eagles, they riot all the time in Philly. Chicago in 1991 through 93, that was basketball. Denver in 96, the Avalanche is a hockey team. 98, the Broncos. 99, 2001, the Avalanche hockey team again. And in Cleveland in 1974, baseball team. All right, sit with it. It's time for the Way Black History Fact, sponsored by Underground Beach Club, from the streets to the beach. The finest in beachwear, visit undergroundbeachclub.com. Today I'll be reading from the National Museum of African American History and Culture / the Smithsonian. Shout out to our people over at the Smithsonian for working with us all the time. We're discussing widespread and pervasive stereotypes of African Americans. All right. Stereotypes of African Americans grew as a natural consequence of both scientific racism and legal challenges to both their personhood and citizenship. In the 1857 Supreme Court case, Dred Scott versus John F. A. Sanford, Chief Justice Roger B. Taney discussed the humanness of those of African descent. This legal precedent permitted the image of African Americans to be reduced to caricatures in popular culture. Decades-old ephemera and current-day incarnations of African American stereotypes, including Mammy, Mandingo, Sapphire, Uncle Tom, and Watermelon, have been informed by the legal and social status of African Americans. Many of the stereotypes created during the height of the transatlantic slave trade were used to help commodify Black bodies and justify the business of slavery. For instance, an enslaved person forced under violence to work from sunrise to sunset could hardly be described as lazy, yet laziness, as well as characteristics of submissiveness, backwardsness, lewdness, treachery, and dishonesty, historically became stereotypes assigned to African Americans. The Mamie stereotype developed as an offensive racial caricature constructed during slavery and popularized primarily through minstrel shows. Enslaved Black women were highly skilled domestic workers, working in the homes of white families and caretakers for their children. The trope painted a picture of domestic workers who had undying loyalty to their slaveholder as caregivers and counsel. This image ultimately sought to legitimize the institution of slavery. The Mammy stereotype gained increased popularity after the Civil War and into the 1900s. During this time, her robust, grinning likeness was attached to mass-produced consumer goods, from flour to motor oil. Considered a trusted figure in white imaginations, Mammies represented contentment and served as nostalgia for whites concerned about racial equality. The Pearl Milling Company's incarceration of the smiling domestic Aunt Jemima became synonymous with the Mammy stereotype. In 1899, the company hired real-life cook Nancy Green to portray the character at various state and world affairs. The stereotype and the overweight, self-sacrificing, and dependent Mammy figure would grow alongside the American film industry through works including Birth of a Nation, Imitation of Life, and Gone with the Wind. All right, Uncle Tom. Uncle Tom, written by Harriet Beecher Stowe in 1852, featured the title character as a large, broad-chested, powerfully made man whose truly African features were characterized by an expression of grave and steady good sense, united with much kindliness and benevolence. He forfeits his own chance at escaping bondage and loses his life to ensure the freedom of other slaves. It's a much different idea of what Uncle Tom means in the Black community today. Mm. All right. The stereotype of Uncle Tom is innately submissive, obedient, and in constant desire of white approval. The term became popular during the Great Migration when many Southern-born blacks moved to northern cities like New York, Chicago, and Detroit. With them, they brought codes of conduct expected in hostile Jim Crow environments. The stereotype was first publicly recorded during an address by Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association member, Reverend George Alexander McGuire, in 1919. Do not call a black person an Uncle Tom unless you know what you're talking about. That is a serious accusation.
Even please be prepared.
Be very careful to deal with that. All right, Sapphire. The Sapphire caricature from the 1800s to the mid-1900s popularly portrayed black women as sassy, emasculating, and domineering. Unlike the mammy figure, this trope depicted African-American women as aggressive, loud, and angry, in direct violation of social norms. The Sapphire stereotype earned its name on the CBS television show Amos and Andy, in association with the character Sapphire Stevens. Airing from 1951 to 1953, with an all-black cast, Sapphire Stevens was the wife to George Kingfish Stevens, a character depicted as ignorant and lazy, fueling Sapphire's rage. During the Jim Crow period, when blacks were often beaten, jailed, or killed for arguing with whites, these fictional characters would pretend to chastise whites, including men. Their sassiness was supposed to indicate their acceptance as members of the white family, and acceptance of that sassiness was implied that slavery and segregation were not overly oppressive. Watermelon. Before it became a racist stereotype in the Jim Crow era, watermelon once symbolized self-sufficiency among African Americans. Following emancipation, many Southern African Americans grew and sold watermelons, and it became a symbol of their freedom. Many Southern whites reacted to this self-sufficiency by turning the fruit into a symbol of poverty. Watermelon came to symbolize a feast for the unclean, lazy, and childlike. To shame black watermelon merchants, popular ads, and including postcards, pictured African Americans stealing, fighting over, or sitting in streets eating watermelon. Watermelons being eaten hand to mouth without utensils made it impossible to consume without making a mess, and therefore branded a public nuisance. All right, last one. Mandingo, the black buck. Conjured by the minds of enslavers and auctioneers to promote strength and breeding ability and agility of muscular young black men, the Mandingo trope was born. While under the violence of enslavement, a physically powerful black man could be subdued and brutally forced into labor. Emancipation brought with it fears that these men would exact sexual revenge against white men through their daughters, as depicted in the film Birth of a Nation. The reinforcement of the stereotype of the Mandingo as animalistic and brutish gave legal authority to white mobs and militias who tortured and killed black men for the, quote, safety of the public. Headlines of newspapers across the nation beginning around the turn of the century documented a frenzy of arrests, attempted lynchings, and murders of black brutes accused of insulting or assaulting white women. I feel like this is kind of the reason that they were able to rile so many people up and take the life of Emmett Till. Heavyweight boxing champion Jack Johnson epitomized the Mandingo or black brute of white imaginations in the flesh. Called a beast, brute, and a coon in print, Johnson's relationships with white women took up as much newsprint as his fighting abilities. With his 1910 victory over James Jeffries, promoted as the Great White Hope, Johnson brought white fears to a head. The result was weeks of riotous mob violence across the nation that left thousands of African-American communities and lives in ruin. So that's just a handful of stereotypes, that the origins of a lot of those stereotypes, and they've evolved and they've taken on new shapes. But, you know, those are harmful. They shape outcomes. Clearly, we talked about, I mentioned Emmett Till. You know, that it, had they not been coerced into thinking something that wasn't true,
they didn't really have to be coerced, though.
I think they got what they wanted. Yeah.
I mean, that was just what we like to call now just their already things they already believed being confirmed.
Yeah. Confirmation bias. Yeah. Well, a lot to think about today. I'd like to thank you all for tuning in once again to Civic Cypher. I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
I am continually, perpetually, mentally and emotionally exhausted because these things are true every day, not just when we crack our microphones to tell you about them. And so many of the things that come across our desk, we don't even get to talk about.
Sure. We left a lot on the cutting room floor, as it were, but we do appreciate your continued support. And hit us up, civiccypher.com. Follow us on social media.
Like, comment, share.
Yeah, hit us on YouTube.
You can be critical too. Talk to us.
Yeah, we talk back. And do me a favor, send Q some love. All right. And until next week, y'all.
Peace.
Peace. Hey, yo, we handle it. These brothers are fabulous. Dilated, showing you where rhyme travel is. Worlds are spit tunes from sunlight to moon. Bussing off stage like gunfight saloons. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders. With press passes, we bring it to you as it happens. The streets love my crew for music and rapping. Street commander slash beat expander. Here to fight the slander with the proper propaganda. What's happening? You got a question, then ask it. The news is just a TV show, get past it. And this from a quiet wartime journalist. Headlines, wake up, refuse and resist. Like this.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs.
Tune in to Pathways
on www.kboo.fm. Thanks for tuning in.
Join me, host Paul O'Brien, or my co-host Donald Altman every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 a.m. You can find out more about the show or listen to the program archive at kboo.fm/pathways.
I'm way, going through Yorkshire, because you're in Yorkshire, going through Yorkshire.